You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
You are listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM LP. I am your host, Steve Niebels, sitting in for David Gilmore, who is taking a little break. Today on Sound Poetry, we welcome Vashon Island poet Sandra Noel. Sandra Noel works as a freelance illustrator and graphic designer, developing award-winning environmental education posters, brochures, exhibits, and interpretive signs. Her poems have appeared in Pontoon, Protest Poems, Buddhist Poetry Review, Bellowing Ark, Alohi Garugi Journal, and others. She's had four chapbooks published, entitled The Gypsy in My Kitchen and Into the Green from Finishing Line Press, The River from Kelsey Press, and Unraveling the Endless Knot from Middle Creek Publishing. Love Island is her latest. It's a full-length poetry book published by Goldfish Press. Love Island and four others are available for purchase at Vashon Bookshop, as well as Starving Artist Works, Thriftway, and Amazon, and at her website, www.noeldesigninterp.com. Welcome, Sandra Noel.
Thank you. It's nice to meet you, Steve.
Yeah, we finally meet. Why don't you just start off with one of the poems from your new book?
Sure. I live, as you know, on Vashon Island. And this recent book through Goldfish Press is mostly about Vashon. This first one is called Return Again. Return Again. Save me the dried apples. Save me the sweet jam made from last summer's blackberries. For I will return again, always to this island where light silvers over the wide bay, morning and evening, and wild voices call me awake and to sleep. From the trees and the open air, I will always return, even as bones and dust, to rest at last by this quiet shore.
Now that's a passion for the place you live.
Yeah.
That's really nice. How long have you lived on Vashon Island?
I moved here in 1987.
Oh, I see. So a long time.
A long time, yes.
Do you feel like you know everybody there?
No. Vashon is one of those places where you can know everybody or nobody.
Oh.
Yes, and I was a parent here for a number of years. My son was raised here, and I knew all the parents during his years in school. But you can be pretty autonomous here.
There's a lot of woods you can hide out in on Vashon Island, right? Yeah, you can be down one of those roads off the main road, and with a long winding driveway, and have a house that resides on a cliff, looking out towards either side of Puget Sound. This next one, Stone and Bone.
Yes. In my working life years ago, I was a fisheries biologist, and I had an interest in the salmon, of course, here in the Northwest, and over the years. And this particular poem is about the streams we have coming up on to Vashon. We have two major salmon streams here. And so this poem is about one of them. And it's called Stone and Bone. I want to become a stone in this meandering river, large enough to hold my place through spring floods, small enough for a returning salmon to consider, nose me gently before struggling a little further upstream, where she will dig into lighter gravel, a nest for her bright orange eggs, attracting the blood-colored males already on their way to death. until both open-mouthed mix eggs and seed together, and after she covers each nest, no longer able to resist the relentless downstream current as it carries her spent body gently back over hard-won riffled river water to be the last place she rests, stone and bone together, bleached white and worn with weather, water, and time, inanimate, unnoticed, dreaming. One molten, born in a river of fire, cooled to stillness by a river of ice. The other, a silver sea traveler, until natal desire compels her into sinuous red light.
That's lovely. That's
thank you.
It's interesting how the life of salmon appears in so much art.
Yes, especially here.
I don't usually think of Vashon as a place that has a lot of streams, and it takes a bit of stream in order to provide a bed for salmon to.
Yes, we have two, Judd Creek and Shingle Mill Creek, both.
Well, I hope that people are taking good care of them.
Absolutely.
Read another one.
Okay, this one's a little different. It's called The Wave of Forever. And I wrote this while I was running on a trail in Island Center Forest, actually, in the middle of winter. It was pretty chilly. With The Wave of Forever. The cold feels clean, my breath evident, walking over the rise toward the Valley of the Firs. If I close my eyes, the cold creeps into my bones, asking for more. But I am not ready to answer, though somehow, with your quiet passing, it does not seem mysterious. We live and we die. The deer carcass beside the road, an old cedar stump. Through the crystalline fields, diminutive marsh wrens rise like a shout. Disturbed from their cold retreats by my passing, we are a small ripple through the great wave of forever.
That's a nice comment on mortality, for one thing.
Yes.
But also the natural world, the way that we can see this happening all around us. You know, I've lived in a city quite a bit, and I think about how the city kind of hammers you into an unconsciousness of the actual world that you live in, that you're not really very aware of how vulnerable you are to Mother Nature, actually, who is always there. You know, the natural world is always there, and we always are vulnerable to it. Birds are one of the things that you do see in the city.
Yes.
So, moving right along.
The next poem I'd like to read is called Place, and it is about that idea of where you live. And this is about where I live, and it's called Place. This island born of ice fingers, reaching down from Canada, rests in the middle of an inland sea where a people lived 6,000 years before. Bones and stone tools still wash from glacial till in storm tides. Cedar stumps carry scars from springboard notches when all the trees, were cut down to build communities and clear the land for farms, where Japanese families grew strawberries until they were moved to camps to wait out a war they did not start. This island, born of ice fingers, resting in the middle of an inland sea, where I came to rest, blown by a hard wind westward to this place.
Well, that sounds like it has a story behind it.
It does.
I heard some years ago that Japanese farmers did a lot of stump removal in the Pacific Northwest. But where were all the trees cut down?
What the entire island?
Oh, okay.
It was completely logged. There are no old growth trees on this island, not a single one.
And do you know when that was?
Oh, about 100 years ago, or a little longer. Yeah. When people first began to move here, white settlers moved here and shipped all the Indians off and began communities on the island. And there are still families here who were here back then. I mean, the graveyard here, we have a marvelous graveyard, and it has dates for people who were here before the Civil War.
That's not an uncommon story of all the trees being cut down. All of my life, having lived in the Pacific Northwest, I've been watching the urban encroachment on the natural world. And of course, and like that's not, in my lifetime, that's not old growth. It's second growth being cut down to build houses. And there was an interesting story. There was a guy that I ran into whose father had a farm out where South Center is now. Mm-hmm. And the story he told was just that eventually the land became too valuable to be farmland.
Yes.
I think that there's some irony there, because I think that in this part of the country, eventually it may be necessary to return some of the land to farmland here, because this may be one of the few places that has a climate that's arable.
Yeah.
I know that's kind of a dark thought, isn't it?
No, it's true. I mean, as a biologist, I can tell you that is true. A temperate rainforest where we live here will probably be one of the last vestiges of habitable environment in the world if we keep going.
Yeah.
I wish I could brighten that up a bit, but I can't. Really.
Well, no, I don't think so. I am fully in agreement with you. I am entirely disturbed by that that concept. Your next poem.
This one is from a chapter called Unraveling the Endless Knot. And in Buddhism, the endless knot is how everything is connected together and in a seamless way. And Unraveling the Endless Knot is, these are poems about how things have been taken apart environmentally over the years and on this planet. And this first poem is called The Last Migration. There are multitudes of bright souls on the wing, on their way north or south, depending on the season, depending on the latitude, gliding overhead in V formations. Their mission is peace, seeking a place to rest. But where the great plains welcome, now a drought has wiped away even the chaff. And to the east, the forests are on fire. Still they come, but fewer and fewer each year, until the day when we look up and see only empty sky.
Where were you when you wrote that?
Watching geese over a pond on Vashon.
Oh, okay, on Vashon. I love the big flocks of geese, and they're talking to each other while they're flying, you know, and you always kind of wonder what they're saying. And they don't discriminate about where they land. Christy, my wife often talks about the freeway geese, you know, because they land in these freeway ponds, you know, these ponds that have been, that are just for runoff from the freeway, right? And you'll go by and there'll be a whole bunch of geese living there.
Canada geese, mostly. Canada geese are pretty much, they get along as best they can around humanity and make the best of it.
So in this poem, you're suggesting that there'll come a time when we don't see the big geese flying over anymore.
Well, I think with the current situation with global warming, I feel that without immediate action, there are more and more species will probably be unable to reach, especially with long migration patterns like geese. They have to go through several latitudes. They have to go through several countries. There's a lot of problems that could occur along the way. Whales have the same issues. The waters are warming in the oceans, and so they are migrating through situations they're normally not exposed to, that kind of thing. The biology of life, I mean, what they're used to, they will adapt. They will adapt as best they can until they can't.
And, well, how about that? This just happens to be your next poem is just the perfect poem to speak to that.
about the northern species, the polar bears. It's called The Missing Vocabulary of the Divine. In Inuit, there are over 50 words for snow. Will they melt syllable by syllable with the ice caps? Float among the icebergs with stranded, starving polar bears? Sift letter by letter between empty rib cages and eye sockets? Will there be 50 words for loss when we are finally done?
That's a 50 words for loss when we're finally done. But when we're finally done, will there be any words left?
We don't know.
I was just thinking of a planet devoid of humanity. Where would all the words be then?
Well, you know, if it's devoid of humanity, it will probably recover.
Planet. I'm not so worried about the planet itself.
Oh, I don't know. Most people, when you think about it, there have been changes geologically over time in millions and millions and millions of years where this sort of thing is pretty much nothing. We're a blink of an eye.
Right.
Just a blink of an eye. That's all we are, humanity.
Well, you know, I in my imagination, we will be a longer blink. that's the question, is how long is this blink going to last?
Exactly. The mitigation is important.
So, coming to rest.
My old tool shed. I have one of those. Everybody does, I think. And I was staring at that thing of last summer thinking I ought to clean this thing out. And I noticed all this activity in there, and there were spiders and mice, and everything just sort of took over. So I wrote this poem. Coming to rest in the old tool shed, among the rusted rakes and empty paint cans, field mice have taken up residence. Sure, the owner has abandoned it, are bold, building their nest in the open. Spiders belay overhead on silken threads. It once held 100 useful things for gardening, fixing a broken wheel, a missing shingle, a child's toy. I think civilization on the downturn will look like this, overgrown with neglect, coming to rest at last as nest and shelter for small, wild things.
I've often thought about that, how humans tend to see the rest of creatures as a nuisance. Because the birds build nests in your gutters, and the mice get in your house and nibble at your grains that you have stored. And of course, people will always talk about how the deer eat their gardens, what a nuisance they are. And so you could see it the other way around, that there's a human infestation and that humans are a nuisance to the other creatures who live on the planet. That in some respects that's kind of nice that your shed is being utilized by these other life forms. You probably don't see it that way. But you live where the beach is always a part of life every day.
Absolutely. Yes, I used to do a beach walk. I'm a biologist by profession, originally. And so I did a beach walk here for 20 years. And I spent every summer for a couple of days, we'd go down to the beach and take people in the community and talk about the invertebrates on the beach. It's still a place I go to. I just love going down there, especially at low tide. It's a fascinating place. And this is called Following the Drift. From this beach, the shore bends to the wail of diurnal tides and the Salish Sea that roll past our small island, driving drift and debris on shore, where we wander and wonder, the dog and I, at crab parts and plastic pieces, so similar in color and frequency, though one will eventually succumb to wind, weather, and tide, the other remains long past its usefulness, if it ever had any. The dog's interest and mine are curiosity, but I do not taste or chase or just observe, sometimes collect. My pockets are always full. Sometimes sand sifts through my dreams.
Does it really?
Yeah. Well, I love the beaches here and anywhere. I'll go to a beach anywhere.
There again, it is a treasure of a trove of life. There's always all of these living things.
And invertebrates are remarkable creatures. I mean, they really are.
Did you have a beach where you grew up? Did you grow up by a saltwater?
No, I grew up in Virginia. I grew up in horse country in Virginia, Fredericksburg, Virginia. Very far from here.
Virginia does have ocean beaches.
They do, but my parents and I never went to them. We always ended up going to Florida.
Really?
Yeah.
So you went to Florida beaches?
Yeah. Yeah. But for different reasons. The East Coast is a very foreign place to me now. I haven't been back there since I was 21.
Yeah. They started populating that a long time ago and just kept right on populating it. That's what that I noticed when I've been to the East Coast is how dense the population is on the East Coast.
Yes.
But I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and as a child going to the beach, that's a tremendous experience to go there and turn over a rock and find all of the little crabs. Yes. and all of the little creatures that are there all of the little fish. I still look for little tiny fish in tide pools.
Yes. I raised my son here, and he's the same way, although he moved back to North Carolina, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
So, but he was raised on these beaches too, and they're really remarkable.
Okay. So, these are, you're right. These are really, a lot of these are Vashon Island, aren't they?
Yes.
This next one has frogs in it. I love frogs.
Well, this is from Into the Green. It's a chapbook through Finishing Line Press from 2017. There's beautiful places on this island to just go. I'm a runner and I spend a lot of time out there. But this one's called Into the Green. Just off Cove Road and a few miles down the trail, past the sleeping pond, wait there a moment for the osprey's shadow. A layer of white mist rises with the sun, revealing indigo blue beneath, and then on again into the green, moving with animal grace I do not possess, but possessed by it here, and further along as the trail bends like a meandering river. A flock of geese overhead flow in a river of sky. I drift in these currents until time to return again past the pond, now wide awake with sound of frogs and the wings back to the road and the world outside.
Another place that is really always a real pleasure to go is a pond, freshwater pond. You know, do you have a freshwater source close enough to you so you hear frogs at night where you live?
Well, we're on an area called the Burton Loop. Uh-huh. And we don't really hear frogs. What we hear are coyotes at night.
Oh, yeah. Wow. How do coyotes do out there on the island?
They do pretty well. They love house cats. I don't have any, but some people do. And if they don't keep them in at night, then you see a lot of little signs saying, where's our kitty? So But cats should be kept in at night because house cats tend to prey on birds and birds, young birds like geese, goslings and things like that. So it's best to keep them in at night.
I hope all of our listeners listen to that and pay attention to that. So what is this next poem?
Well, I've had the opportunity to work in Sulawesi, Indonesia as a volunteer for a group called Alliance for Tompatika, and they do a lot of conservation work down there with endangered species like the Malayo bird and some turtle species. And what I mainly do is work with kids doing artwork projects and that kind of thing. And the Wallace line, this particular poem, Crossing the Wallace Line, has to do with Alfred Lord Wallace, who was a contemporary of Darwin. And in fact, Alfred Lord Wallace's discoveries in Sulawesi, Indonesia, were mimicking or repeating a lot of what Darwin had been working on. And Wallace did not want to publish before Darwin did, because he felt Darwin's data and information on the beagle, the work that he'd done, and his research was far ahead of him. And so he gave him the opportunity to publish first, which in the academic and scientific world is pretty reasonable stuff. Normally they'll just jump to go ahead and publish first, but Wallace didn't do that. He felt Darwin was the scientist who really discovered the idea of evolution. So at any rate, this is about this area where he studied, and it's called Crossing, and I was there, and it's an amazing place. Crossing the Wallace Line. A full moon spills her silver light over the bay. Bhutan Beach is glittering with seashells and plastic trash. Brave fishermen in small outriggers bob like toy boats, too fragile to survive the dark wave shadows rolling in from an offshore typhoon. I am just a visitor here without the necessity of bravery or trying to fit in, to be easy, because I cannot think of another place on earth I would rather be than under these stars on this island where Wallace drew his imaginary line, and the creatures born in evolutionary isolation still struggle to survive until the next fire, the next desire for hardwood or hard-ons, more land or bushmeat. With palm frond pen, I draw a line in the sand between perfect shell and plastic lighter, as if I could stop what is coming, the great grinding wheel of greed rolling over forests, beaches, species. So many others have tried and failed. The line is broken 1,000 acres a day, and so they leave, having done nothing, almost nothing, learning only to love what they cannot save, and living with that hard truth every day, but trying anyway.
I don't generally think of Indonesians as trying very hard to save their forests and their all their natural beauty. Indonesia is a really geographically immense space, right?
Yes. Indonesian people, the ones who live in places like Sulawesi, are remarkable. They are, it's one of the largest Muslim countries, by the way, in the world.
Right.
And many of the people who live in the villages along the coastline are very poor, but they are also very concerned about wildlife and how things are sustained in their area. They don't really have a lot of opportunity, but they tend to want to preserve what they have.
Right. One thing about people who are not living the same kind of resource-rich life that we live is that they often don't have resources. They have to be very creative. In order to save anything, they're often in a position where their desperation is a danger to the natural environment.
Sure. There's sometimes it's just a choice between whether they survive or whether they don't in terms of resources. But a lot of work's being done down there by specific groups Alliance for Tompatika, for one, which works with two villages specifically, and have had a lot of success. There was a Malayo bird, it was almost on the edge of extinction, and some of these groups working with people in the areas of these villages convinced them not to take the eggs and sell them outside the country, but to protect the areas and to provide them with funds that would allow them to be able to do that. And so that intervention has actually literally saved a species.
I don't know. Anyway, I just, you're hitting on subject matter I'm kind of interested in, you know,
Oh, good.
So flying fox, you know, I found this to be, this is about the very subject that I have been talking about. So why don't you read that to us?
I will. This is written down when or at least the beginnings of it was written when I was down in Sulawesi on a little island. And I had the opportunity to see flying foxes resting in the trees. They're huge. And seeing them fly overhead. Flying foxes. An old friend drunk one night in Seattle, when I asked if she wanted to go downtown to a bar and hear some music, said, "Bars were places where people go to hang upside down like bats." I never forgot that, even after the two of us stopped speaking to one another for 20 years. The last bats I saw were hanging out on Bat Island in Sulawesi, Indonesia. Flying foxes, thousands of them, left at dusk to feed on rainforest nectar and return to the island at dawn. As we watched their silent shadows pass overhead, I was reminded of her words and our friendship, marred perhaps by too much of every damn thing, alcohol, drugs, and pretty useless men, too much sweetness in the night. The flying foxes on Bat Island were all killed last year for the illegal bushmeat trade. It makes me want to call her up, go downtown together, and hang upside down for a while.
There's an example of what we were talking about, the population being desperate enough to wipe out a population of
yes.
creatures. And I haven't ever seen them, but I that seems really fascinating. I know a lot of people are afraid of bats. They have they're bat phobic. Bats eat insects in this part of the country. And mm-hmm. And so if you have a big mosquito population, a bat colony could be your friend.
Yes. They're good critters.
Do you see a lot of bats on Vashon?
We have bats on Vashon that every summer they fly through our bedroom window, and we leave the door and the window open and shut the door to the room so they don't continue through the house, but they literally fly in our window and back out and leave.
Right. I think that in the Pacific Northwest, if you're anywhere near a forest, you're likely to encounter bats. And of course, around here, they're pretty small. As a general rule, and
yeah.
they're really cute little things. Actually, they're
little brown myotis.
They're little flying mice, essentially.
Yeah, little flying mice, pretty much.
That's a sad story, you know. There's another thing is that I say that's a sad story. Somebody else would go, "Oh, good riddance to the bats," you know. But yeah, it seems really sad to me that people would do that.
Yeah. This poem, the woman that runs the organization, Alliance for Tompatika, Marcy Summers, is one of the most remarkable environmentalists I've ever met. And this is about her. It's called "Lois Lane and Superman Take a Walk." Noval and the cicadas tune their instruments by the fire at Alto Camp, as a giant orange sherbet sun melts slowly on the horizon, painting everything golden, even our faces. Marcy walks over with that smile, the secret one I know, and leads me down the beach. Look, wait, the magic words, "I don't ask what miracle is coming," as she points to a small plane tree, barely visible in the darkness. One small intermittent glow appears, then another and another, and in the space of a minute, to the beat of my heart, until the tree is transformed into a pulsing sphere of light, a nebula of fireflies. Then one by one, they all fly up into a sea of stars as if to take their rightful places. We stroll back up the beach while she explains synchronic flashing of Southeast Asian fireflies, and I feel just like Lois Lane with Superman walking home after a flight over Metropolis as he explains how gravity works, just not on him.
Yeah, that's really funny. I really like that last line.
Thank you.
But it makes me want to see those fireflies.
This one's out of the new book. Once Upon an Island. We were American refugees, huddled around our wood stoves, drinking wine and smoking pot over cribbage and conversation, too young to think beyond the next day's fishing. Some did not survive to the old age we feared. The rest of us left to remember, setting the boats on buoys, waiting for the tide to lift us all and bring the salmon, those great wily wild ones, into our leads and nets. Nothing I have done since has been done with such abandon, not even love.
Well, thank you very much, Sandra. It's been great having you here with Sound Poetry. I'm Steve Niebel. This is Sound Poetry. I've spent the day with Sandra Noel. And we can get your poems at Vashon Bookstore, or you said your local Vashon grocery stores, or Amazon.
And there's a little bookstore in West Seattle.
And you have them on your website, too.
Yes, they're on and Amazon.
So if you just look for Sandra Noel online, you can find her website.
Yes.
and buy her books from her. Well, thank you very much, Sandra, for being with us here today on Sound Poetry.
Thank you so much, Stephen. I really appreciate this.